Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. If my memory serves me correctly, the previous talk which I gave here, I was talking about the mechanism of insight, and especially using the Buddhist framework of the three vipalasas, the perversions of view, perception and thought, to indicate just how it's so hard to gain wisdom, simply because as we view things, that bends our perception to fit, and our thoughts are bent by our perceptions, and our thoughts build up and justify our views. And as such, the circle of delusion, which keeps us getting reborn, which keeps us seeking delight ever here and there, which keeps us taking that which is non-self to be self, that which is suffering to be happiness, that which is impermanent to be permanent, as somebody pointed out, that which is ugly to be beautiful. These are the examples, but most important examples, of how we can misunderstand, we can misperceive, we can misthink about the nature of life. And obviously the process of insight is the practice, the mechanism by which we can break through that cycle, that cognitive distortion, so that we can see clearly this thing we call the way things truly are, yata bhuta yanadasana. Yanadasana is like knowledge and vision, as they say, and yata bhutang, as they truly are, as they are. And knowledge of things as they truly are is the common description of what insight is, and it seems to be so obvious what things are. You ask anybody what things are, and they obviously say they're like this. And what Putrajanas don't realize, the ordinary people don't realize, is that what you take to be the way things are is not the way things truly are. This is why it's deluded. You can observe, you can hear, you can smell, taste, touch, you can cognize with the mind, but even that bare perception which arises in the jitta, that is not truth, that has already been bent to suit the purposes of the defilements and becomes untrustworthy. And this is what I was mentioning at great length in the talk last week, just to stress and to point out with illustrations how untrustworthy even our bare perceptions are. So when people say that you should just be mindful of your bare perceptions and take that to be truth and that to be the basis of insight, that is very dangerous. Because that is not the basis of insight at all. That can be the basis of more delusion. Simply because that data which you're working from has already been bent to fit the purposes of the defilements. And later on, as we practice deeper and deeper, we can actually uncover that delusion. And we can understand why it is that many people are stuck to samsara, and few there are, as they say in the suttas, who cross to the further shore. And I was stressing last week how the practice is always through samadhi, as it says in the suttas, not once but hundreds of times, that the cause for seeing things as they truly are is always samadhi. Samadhi is the cause for seeing things as they truly are. And that's said again and again by the Buddha and by the noble disciples. Even to the point, there's one of my favourite quotes, which says, samadhi mago, asamadhi kumago. Samadhi is the path, is the magga. And asamadhi, which means no samadhi, is the wrong path. A very powerful statement in the suttas. So that we have to somehow develop that samadhi. The degree of samadhi which you need is sometimes argued about, but is quite clear. The best type of samadhi is the samadhi which occurs when one emerges from a jhana, because as anyone who's experienced those states would know, that after one emerges from these deep states of meditation bliss, the thing which we call the five hindrances are gone for long periods of time. And that is always the most powerful state, and it is usually the state where many people see the Dhamma and gain those insights, those powerful insights, which actually lead to the liberations, which lead to Magapala, the enlightenment. It is possible before you gain jhanas, because before you gain jhanas, just before, the hindrances are also abandoned. However, that is unstable. After the jhana is the stable state of the hindrances being overcome. And also that one doesn't really know whether the hindrances are overcome or not. And we can give talks on the five hindrances, and just like many other parts of the Dhamma, you may think you know what those five hindrances are. You know, Kamachanda, sometimes Lokeya Bija, it's a synonym for Kamachanda. So often you read, of course, sensory desire. That means, this is quite clear if you understand Pali, it means that the desire which is based on the five senses, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, the five external senses, not the desire of the sixth sense of the mind, the happiness of that sense is allowed. The happiness of that sense is the middle path, which avoids the indulgence, the search for desire in the five senses, which avoids the harm, the hurting, the asceticism of the five senses, and goes, or the six senses you might say, and goes for the one thing which is not covered by indulgence in the five senses or the austerity of the six senses, which is obviously is the happiness of that sixth sense. That's why it's the middle path. And that's why that middle path, the Eightfold Path, culminating in jhanas, the happiness of the mind. That's why that is called the middle way. And before or after, yeah, but after jhanas, that is, the hindrances are overcome. But to ever know what those hindrances are, Kamachanda, to know what that truly is, to know what Vyapada, ill will, truly is, what Udicca Kukkaccha, so restlessness and remorse, what Tinamida, sloth and torpor, what Vitikicca, what doubt truly is. You may read it in the suttas, you may write an essay about it, but the only time that you experientially know what those things are is when they're overcome. And the time when you know they're overcome is when you're in jhanas. And the experience of in jhanas shows you what it's like when there are no hindrances. And when they are absent, from the perspective of absence, you know what those things are. The old simile of, you know, of a tadpole in the water. Tadpole cannot know what water is until it gets out of the water and knows what not water is. You know that what the hindrances are when they're all gone. When they're all gone, then, from that perspective, you can understand fully what these five hindrances are. This is one of the problems with the practices. Even getting insight into the nature of the hindrances is so difficult. It's only when they're completely gone do we know, ah, that's what they were. But to gain those that stage of the hindrances completely gone, that's when the mind is clear. But once that mind is clear, the whole purpose of this evening's talk is what to do next. And it's an important aspect of gaining insight, because after the hindrances have been abandoned, and they do happen to few people practicing, not everybody, it does happen sometimes when you least expect it, that jhanas sometimes just happen to you. And it's important actually to be instructed exactly what to do after you've experienced a state like that, so you don't waste those experiences. Those are the windows of opportunities to see the Dharma as it truly is, to gain the penetrative insight which can possibly give you stream winning or even more than that. And always the best thing to do after you've gained those states, when the hindrances are gone, what I usually say, this is really not part of the emphasis of this talk, but it's probably worthwhile mentioning this to make this instruction clear, is that once you've had a good experience, is to reflect back upon it first of all, you know, what it is and how you got there, to get skill in the achievement of those states, because you know, usually you have to get back there quite a few times. So at least you know exactly what that was, and more importantly why, what you did. And all the time, it's fascinating when I get some of the data from my talks, not just from my own experience, but from the experience of others. As a teacher, you talk to people, and you get some a wide sample of experiences, and it's just very noteworthy, remarkable, that people who do get into deep meditation, to jhanas, they always seem to use the same two words. They really let go, and three words are really, truly, absolutely let go. They push the letting go button properly for a change. And it's important that one considers that, one reflects upon that, and what letting go truly means. They let go fully enough to gain those jhanas. And it's an important realization, because it shows you the way into these states is not a way of striving. It's not a way of controlling. It's not a way of reaching out and craving for something. It's always stages of letting go. They are not stages of attachments. You don't get attached to those jhanas. You don't get stuck in those states. Because if you realize what they are, you realize they can only be gained through letting go. They are states of letting go. The more you let go, the more that is abandoned, the more that disappears, the more that goes to emptiness, the deeper those jhanas become. And this actually is both a teaching of what letting go means, and also the manifestation of that teaching. It is, as it were, the path, but also the manifestation of the goal of that path. And that's why it becomes a very powerful pointer to what the Dharma is. So, first thing we always should do is to reflect back upon that experience. What was that? Why was that? You know, to get some idea of causality, which is obviously an important aspect of the Dharma of the Buddha. It doesn't come from you. It's not a sort of a willed state. Obviously, that if it's willed, it comes from the sense of self, and that is obviously unskillful, inappropriate. It comes always from a case of letting go, a sense of anatta. And indeed, one of the things which should be really done next, once you say why and what was that like, is to try and look at those experiences through one of the three lenses of anicca, dukkha, anatta. These are the three ways, I think they're called the three gateways of liberation. And they're called the three gateways of liberation for a very important reason, that usually that people gain stream winning or above through reflecting upon the experience through those lenses, as it were, through seeing the anicca nature of what's happened and what's happening, to see the dukkha nature of what's happened and happening, and to see the anatta nature of what's happened and happening. Remember that this thing we call mindfulness, it's not just knowing the present moment. It's actually taking those experiences which are already gone. It's looking to the past, but taking those experiences of the past, placing them in the present as objects of investigation. And so you take those experiences, especially the path in and the experience itself, and you start to look, say, anicca. Now, anicca, what that truly means, the English words, impermanence, instability, or whatever, are obviously just nowhere near sort of adequate to describe the experiences themselves. And whether it comes from the Zen teaching, which is fingers pointing at the moon, or whether they come from Western teachings of the understanding of language, other metaphors of words only being like the menus and they're pointing to the food, never sort of stop at just the words themselves, impermanence, and think you understand what that means. If you truly understood what anicca meant, then of course, again, you'd be a stream winner. At least, minimum. And it's because we don't fully understand the meaning of that word and the import of it that we are still stuck in samsara. And because we're stuck in samsara, we have all the pain and suffering, the disappointments, the frustrations, you know, the good days and the bad days and all of that sort of stuff. But if we truly understood anicca, then we would hardly have any of that stuff at all. If we fully understood it all the time, we'd have none of that stuff. We'd be arahat, fully enlightened. So I'm mentioning this just to point out that there must be something in there we haven't fully understood yet. We haven't fully seen. So that's why that after a good meditation, it's worthwhile bringing up that concept, that idea to the mind, anicca. What you're doing then, you're instructing the mind, you're pointing it in that direction. Okay, anicca, whatever that means, look in that direction. You can start with just your worldly understanding of that term, anicca, impermanent, you know, it's not constant, and a subject to fading away, subject to change, whatever it is you start off with, that just points you in the general direction. And then you start looking at those experiences. And then, because of the stillness of the mind, because of the brightness of the mind, you can start to see the fuller meaning of anicca. In the last journal article which I did, I mentioned this concept called superpower mindfulness, which people have been reminding me about recently. And obviously that does not correspond to any word in Pali. That's an Ajahn Brahm word, superpower mindfulness. The whole point of that is just from the experience of the amount of mindfulness which you have available, you know, after a deep meditation. It's a reasonable way of describing that mindfulness, which is much more powerful, both in its ability to hold an object and also to bore into it, than ordinary mindfulness. That's why I call it super, because of its energy and its power, because of what it can do. And I've given a simile before. It's like the difference between trying to dig a hole in the ground with a blunt plastic spoon, or with these huge backhoes which are used in the mining operations in Australia. And just these mining operations, just they have these huge buckets and so powerful machines that they can in you know, 5 seconds just take out a huge amount of earth, which will take you maybe, you know, weeks, months, years actually to dig out. And that's like the difference between mindfulness and superpower mindfulness. Just the ability to dig in to the nature of things. So we dig in with anicca. What are we actually going to be seeing? What we're actually being seeing is the fact that all of these things is not just rising and falling like waves on an ocean. That's, you know, if you just see the waves on the ocean, you know, you see that they go up and they go down, but very often people can just assume that the ocean is permanent and that the waves are just the perturbations, the change of something which is always constant. And you can understand where that insight gets you. All that insight gets you is that some sort of God or ground of being or sort of basic principle of life, you know, which is only on the outside changes. Some like Paramatman in the Hindu tradition. Just the essence or whatever. And you just see the essence sort of coming and going, rising and falling, but the essence always being there. And that is obviously a superficial looking at anicca. In that simile of just waves on the surface of a body of water, the experience you get through like the jhanas, the data there, is okay, you see waves on the surface of a lake, sort of rising and falling, going up and down. But in jhanas you see the whole lake disappear. And this is actually the powerful experiences which you get, which are uttari manusa dhamma. This is one of the Pali words. They're beyond just the ordinary human experience. And this is why that those stages are very weird. They are abnormal stages of consciousness. And they're abnormal not just because of their bliss and their power, but just because how they do not relate so well to your ordinary experience of life. It's a whole paradigm shift, a whole different stage of consciousness. And when you look at those differences, one of the major differences is that something which was always there in every conscious moment before is now no longer there. There is something, as it were, which you took to be fundamental has now gone missing. And that's why it becomes quite shocking. Now use that word carefully, shocking, because it's something which you could never see, which you could never expect, which you can never predict. The vipalasas stop you from being able to imagine or even predict that. Something so fundamental and constant, which has always been there and you assume it has to be there, has absolutely completely disappeared. This is what we mean by anicca. There's in the Vinaya, the rules of discipline, there's a section of the Vinaya called the Kandikas. It's usually in the two volumes called the Chulawaga Mahawaga. And in particular, they give a chapter there about the different types of food offerings for monks. And one of the types of food offerings is called nitya meals. And nitya meals are meals which happen, sort of say, every Tuesday or every Wednesday or once a fortnight. Regular meals. Regular in the sense that they come at regular intervals. Almost to the point they are predictable. And of course, you know that in this monastery that we do have, in that sense, many nitya meals. We have people who come on Thursdays, we have people who come on Fridays, we have people who come Monday, Tuesday, Wednesdays, and even when I was on retreat, even the 6 month retreat, sometimes I could tell the day it was by the food which came in my bowl. Because you remember, so certain people give certain food on certain days. And so that was what I mean by nitya vata. It's regular. And obviously you can understand a deeper meaning of anicca now. It's when something which was regular, which was always there, some sort of constancy, has now gone. And this is powerful understanding of what these insights truly are pointing to. When something is always constant, just like the constant sound, the hum of the frequency of the air, you can't really pick it up. The constant sort of flutter of the heater behind me, or the feeling of the saliva in your mouth. Whatever is actually constant, it's just so hard to notice. Except when it disappears. When it goes off. When it stops. And then you realize what was there all the time, which you hadn't seen before. And this is one of the powers of anicca happening. You realize, even for the first jhana, that this body is anicca. It doesn't have to always be there. In fact, the experience in the jhana is completely disembodied. It's a pure mind state. You're not aware of the body. More interestingly, it's the five senses, sight, smell, taste and touch, are completely turned off. That is anicca. It doesn't always have to be there. Even more deep, will is completely turned off in the jhanas. You can't choose, you can't direct, you can no longer steer this vehicle. Now that's powerful when the will disappears. I may have mentioned this before, but in the first jhana the will mostly disappears, but there is still what you might call the echo of the will. The will is what disturbs things, chetana. It makes the mind move. So instead of actually putting it as will as like coming from a being, it might be just called like wobbles of the mind, disturbances of the mind. And so what chetana really does, it just disturbs and messes up all this stuff. And when that will, that chetana, is the choice, doing is actually calmed down, then that's actually the experiences of peace, of samatha, of samadhi. And things come to one pointedness of mind, one peak of mind, and stay there still, not moving. Every will is a movement. And if you look at it more deeply, you find every time you will, it means that you're not content where you are. If you're really content in this moment, and I mean truly content, then will choice cannot arise. All that will, that arising, comes from discontent. You want something, you want to do something, you want to move somewhere. And so the huge deep contentments in the jhanas, they create that space when nothing is moving, when will completely goes, and it's so still that the access to will, the mind cannot access that will. And it's as if not just you've taken the hands off the steering wheel, the steering wheel is so far away you can't see it anymore. It's disappeared, it's anichit. Something which was always there for your whole life, the ability to do, the ability to choose, the ability to be in power, the ability to control, has completely vanished. That's why it's very strange and very weird. I've given all these words, but they only just point to something which is obviously far more powerful than any words can describe. And of course, that anicca of the will shows you very, very powerfully. So that will cannot be a me, a mine, or a self. And this is actually the power of it, to see that all this world, it just comes and it goes, it disappears completely. The result of those insights is that you don't give so much importance to your will, to your doing, to your choosing. It's not such a big thing in your life anymore. As the Buddha kept on saying, the leaves and twigs and grass in the Chaita Grove, you don't really care about them. What happens to them? Why? Because they're not mine. Do you really care about your will, your choice? Of course, you're so attached to that. It's so important to you. So much so that people get very afraid if someone is taking over your mind. What do you mean by taking over your mind? Taking over my will, taking over my choice, brainwashing me, controlling me. I want to be free. Not only that, but once we are free, we're still not content with our will, because our will is sometimes stupid and does the wrong things. And so we get fed up with our will. We tell the will off, you're stupid. We get frustrated with ourselves. Why can't I get this right? And many of you remember that simile for the will of the driver in the front seat of the bus. And this is, we get frustrated until we find actually there's no one there. It's a driverless bus. And the result of seeing that, there's no one in the driving seat. We understand that the bus still goes this way and that way. There is still such a thing as will and choice, but it's not coming from us. It is anicca. What a beautiful liberation that is, to be free from worrying about what we're doing all day. No guilt, no sort of getting upset, no craving. Where does a lot of anger come from? anger towards others, anger towards oneself, from the fact that we realise we're not in control anymore. And life can be so frustrating, can't it? Now, in this monastery, you can't even choose what you want to eat here. Especially when you go further down the line, you may make something very nice and all the fat monks eat it all, so there's nothing left for you. Ugh, these monks. I used to think like that when I was a young monk. Now, when I was a young monk in Thailand, I saw all these fat monks at the top of the line. They got all the best food. And they live in Ajahn Chah, they get all this lovely food, and I used to get sort of the rubbish food at the end of the line. I thought, Ajahn Chah, he's enlightened, he doesn't need the nice food. He doesn't care for him whether he gets nice food or not. You know, he's enlightened, he's beyond that. But I'm not beyond that, I should get all the nice food. We should have all the Anagarikas choosing the food first. Because, you know, they need it. And also that I started sort of getting really cranky about all the senior monks. They used to have the best cushions. Have you ever noticed that? That, you know, the senior monks, they all have the fattest cushions to sit on and the cushions to lean on. And I thought, those monks in northeast Thailand, they're so fat anyway, they didn't need any cushions. But I was so scrawny. I'd eat those cushions more than they did. You can see just how sort of you start to get into this choice and will business and get angry because of this and frustrated because you can't control things. You get frustrated at your body, you can't control it. You're trying to make it healthy, and it comes time for your retreat, and you've got yourself all together for the retreat for the 2 months, or you come all this way to Bodhnyana Monastery for 3 months, and you sort of really get going, and then your body packs up on you. It's just so frustrating, isn't it? Why can't you pack up on me when I'm back in Melbourne or back in Sydney or back in Perth or whatever? This is my retreat time. This is actually teaching us that the body is not under our control. And then we get our mind. Ha-ha. Well, okay, we can understand the body gets sick. But our mind. I mean, that should get into jhana every time, shouldn't it? I mean, how many times have you heard sort of the basic method of meditation, how to get into jhanas? You probably actually know that method better than I do now. I've taught it so many times. Now, what you're supposed to do, and what you're supposed to do with nimittas when they come up. But it doesn't work. I can't get there. There's always something gets in the way. Your stupid mind. Understand that will, choice, is anicca. It sort of comes and it disappears. It's not me, it's not mine. And as we sort of focus on these things more and more and more, and we understand what anicca is, you know, the best thing is to allow all of these things to completely disappear. Anicca, to go to sunyata, to go to emptiness, nothing, completely gone. And these become one of the first experiences you have of anicca, full anicca, of seeing everything disappear. This is why they say that standing on that, this is from the suttas, standing on that experience of seeing something which was always there, fundamental to what your experience of samsara, what you think samsara is, what you think you are, what you think life is, what you think everything is, what you think thinking is. Standing on that experience of seeing something so fundamental, completely gone, it's possible to make the inference, to make the jump, that everything can go. It's possible from that point to perceive the unconditioned, the asankata, the animitta, the unformed. That's one of the gateways to liberation. Based on adicca, you can get the animitta, or vimokkha, or vimutti, whatever it is, the freedom of conditionless, signless, seeing that everything can completely disappear. You're understanding from that point of anicca what how viraga nirodha, nibbana means. Read all these suttas and all these books, and all these scholars have their pet names for these terms. But unless you've gone that path, you don't really know what those words mean. The best dictionary for Pali is your experiences of Samatha Vipassana. When you go to those places, you know exactly what viraga means, nirodha, nibbana means. And viraga is the fading away of things. Things start to disappear. is a manifestation of anicca. Not rise and fall, but fall and not rising for a long time, sometimes falling forever. If it's like the complete abandonment of things, with the mugger and the parlor, they fall never to rise again. That's what anicca means. Something which was regular is completely gone. This is this whole process of things fading away, fading away. The path into jhanas is a gradual fading away, a gradual letting go, as is the path towards the end of suffering, the end of samsara, a gradual letting go of the delusion, a gradual letting go of the defilements, a gradual letting go of the basis of attachments. You see them sort of fading away, their power getting less and less. Even during a retreat you can see a lot of fading away of things, a lot of fading away of delusion, a lot of fading away of hope of control, a fading away of thinking, a fading away of despondency, of fear, of all the emotional manifestations of defilements. You see so many things fading away, attachments fading away, belongings fading away, you fading away. See all these things fading away. That's viraga. And this is actually, you can understand this, is just the process of anicca working, things disappearing. And then if they viraga long enough, they fade away long enough, then they nirodha. Nirodha means they cease. And that is actually the part of the process of anicca, the cessation of things. My goodness, that's amazing to see. To see something which was always there is just now gone. It's just like seeing the Buddha statue on this shrine, which has been there for, 18 years now, 17 years now. Just so heavy, so solid, suddenly just vanish into nothingness. Completely pop out of existence. Seems to go against every law of physics, every law of well, experience, completely irrational, because nothing's ever happened like that before. Just things disappearing, vanishing, going, poof, gone. That's what nirodha is. It's a cessation of things which seem to be so stable, so eternal, which are no longer eternal. That's why the eternity belief is one of the wrong views, the micchadittis of the Buddha. You see these things which were so solid there, which you places where the sense of self and the sense of craving and the sense of attachment could grow. This was like the gardens of those, or rather the waste dumps where all those toxic weeds can grow. And there's no toxic dump anymore, there's no fuel anymore. So they just go, they die. See all these things disappear. Vanish, gone. That's anicca. Now if you're seeing those things disappear and go, my goodness, you've got to understand what nirodha is. From that inference of seeing some big things disappear, it starts to make the rest of experiences start to feel less secure, more fragile. It seems to be the whole world which you thought was solid starts to disintegrate. Solid walls start to become molten like jelly and start to drip away. So they're no longer there anymore. The floor underneath you starts to sway backwards and forwards, and starts the concrete starts to disappear, and whole holes sort of appear beneath you. You've got nothing to stand on. There's nothing there. That which you thought was real and true is all seen to be sankata, to condition, to be formed, to be not something solid which you can really hang anything on. And the whole of samsara starts to melt away into nothingness, into emptiness. There's nothing there. The cessation starts to develop from seeing what's disappeared in the jhana experiences to seeing the whole of everything disappearing. This is the experience of Nibbana. Seeing cessation happened, not happening, happened. That cessation happened is the experience of Nibbana. Nibbana as we just chanted in the Ratana Sutta. What is it? The last one, Kinang. Ati Sambha Wang Virati Chitayati Kepa Wasaming Te Kina Bija Awiwulti Chanda Nibanti Dira Yatayang Padipo. Nibanti Dira Yatayang Padipo. This Nibanti is Nibbanad Yatayang Padipo. Just like this candle or this lamp, this flame, Nibbanas, goes out. Because Kina Bija, the seed of delusion, has been abandoned. And this ayating, what is it? Kina Bija, Awiwulhi Chanda, Nibanti, Awiwulhi Chanda, that the Chanda, desire, craving to do, will, Awiwulhi, is just can no longer grow anymore. Ayating, what is it? Kinang, Natisam, Virata Chitayati Kepa Wasmi. That's what Virata, which is like Viragad, Chit, this mind, this Chitta, the existence of this Chitta, no longer can grow anymore. This is actually just what I remember in a bit of woolly way of that chant we just did. It's just showing what like Nibbana actually is, sort of when cessation has happened. And this is the inference you can get by seeing such a big amount of what you thought to be solid has completely disappeared, anicchad. You understand what that process of viraga, nirodha, nibbana is. And from seeing that, it means that that which you thought to be solid, to be me, to be mine, to be a self, to be real, existent, eternal in the world, whether it's the four elements, or whether it's the five khandhas, or whether it's the ayatanas, the sense bases, or whatever. You see, the whole lot is completely unsolid. The important point is the complete lot is subject to cessation, to nibbana. That much would make you a stream winner. When you allow everything completely disappear with nothing left. The important point is having nothing left at all. This is what it says, the parinibbana, the full nibbana without remainder. It's a beautiful term, without remainder at all. Nothing left. As you actually see this, this is what anicca means. If you look upon it from dukkha, the suffering, this is where you look upon that experience of the jhana, and obviously one of its amazing things there is this bliss and ecstasy. And this is one of the great selling points to this type of meditation. It's just so much fun when you get the hang of it. In fact, it's so much fun, it's more fun than anything else you can do anywhere in samsara. And you can bliss out, having so much happiness that it beats every other experience available in samsara, even in the deva realms, the lower deva realms, the karma loka. No, whether it's the Tawatingsa realm, or the Yama realm, the Tusita realm, the Nimanarati realm, or the Paranimittawasavati realm. You know, all of those realms, okay, they're really sort of, that's heaven realms, but these jhanas are much more than that. So if any sort of Christian asks you that, you know, as a Buddhist you don't go to heaven, you say, I've got something much better than heaven. Your heaven is nothing compared to what I do in my monastery. And that sort of really starts to upset people when they sort of, you know, something much more, deeper, further. And those bliss states are just powerful, and they are great fun. And the Buddha said that they're not dangerous. You no need to fear them. You need to make much of them, develop them. Why? Because it's so unlikely that a person without a man of bliss will not actually inquire with curiosity why they're so happy. When you just want to understand dukkha, this, you know, suffering which people always talk about, you know, the first noble truth, you can only understand dukkha from the ending of dukkha. The same simile again of the tadpole in the lake and leaving the lake. And a lot of times that people don't realize that this is dukkha in this body with all its five senses. And we really think that if we can make these five senses sort of control them and get just happiness with these five senses, beautiful sights, beautiful sounds, go listen to some nice music, you know, having all the CDs and get the music you just like whenever you want, and get people always around you who's always praising you and saying what a wonderful person you are, coming to the interviews and saying, wow, you know, that's jhana which you've just got, you know, that's Magapala. Wouldn't it be nice to come to the interview tomorrow and sort of be told what you did think was a jhana at all, that was jhana and you were fully enlightened? We always want to hear these nice things. We always want to sort of smell and taste beautiful food. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we've got better cooks in this monastery? If we had a menu? I mean, we've got enough money in this monastery. Why don't we actually hire a cook? I mean, a professional cook. Stop messing around and get sort of a menu every day. In fact, we can actually take orders from each one of the monks. So you know what meal you want tomorrow. And if we can't cook it here, we can actually send out some of the best restaurants in Perth and have it delivered. Wouldn't it be wonderful to get the food? All of those of you who are planning to leave this monastery after the range retreat, have you started thinking what you're going to do when you leave yet? Food you're going to go and eat, places you're going to go, the movies you're going to watch. Imagine just the, you know, when you leave, it's only 2.5 weeks to go, you can actually put your feet up in front of the nice television, you can have a sort of nice meal in the afternoon, whatever food you want. Have you been doing that yet? It's stupid, because that's not fun. It looks like it's fun, doesn't it? But it's because that's all we know. That becomes, you know, the purpose of people's lives, to try to sort of find happiness in this realm of the five senses. People build all these big mansions and get all these entertainment centres with amazing sort of music and just high quality sound and digital TV, which has got, you know, you sit in front of these screens, it's almost like being there, surround sound and just 30-40 channels or whatever you want to watch anywhere in the world. You don't even need to go and see the Taj Mahal. You can sort of, you know, have a virtual reality set, I mean, just as if you're really there. You can do whatever you want in this world. That's not happiness. That's just the world of the five senses. And if you just get jhana once and see what that experience is like, my goodness, you realize that these five senses is just like a con trick, like a second-hand car salesman who's selling you just an old bomb of happiness. And you've been buying it. You're buying it all your life, and probably you're still buying it. There was similarly in the sutras, there was this blind man who sold this white cloth by this con artist. It's a beautiful white cloth, blind man. He pays all this money for this white cloth. And it's only this dirty old rag, but the blind man can't see it. But then sort of some doctor comes along and heals his sight. And as soon as his sight is healed, he sees that this cloth he paid so much money for, it's not a white cloth after all. It's not pretty after all. It's just a dirty old rag. And then he gets very cranky at the guy who sold him this, as he would rightly do. Right, similarly, it's just this, you've been sort of been sold this dirty old rag of the five sense pleasures. You know, beautiful feelings in the body, like sex. You know, beautiful like music and movies, and it's exciting, and going here and going there, and seeing a sunset, seeing a baby born, seeing a flower bloom. What a lot of rubbish. That's suffering. But of course people can't see that, they get caught up in that, they buy into it, and that's what makes life go round. We celebrate that because we don't know any more. The whole purpose of having these experiences of deep meditation is to see the underlying delusion there. Taking what is unhappy, suffering, to be happiness. You just get one jhana and you can understand what I'm talking about there. You see that which you thought was happiness is absolute suffering. It's dukkha, it's burning, as we chanted last week. Now the eyes are burning. What's seen by the eyes is burning. The feelings depend upon those eyes are burning. This whole lot is burning. burning is painful, but we got so used to it we don't realize it anymore. But we get just this one little escape into a jhanas where the five senses have completely disappeared and we've got a happiness which is far greater. And reflecting on that shows, why is that happy? Happiness is always because of the ending of some sort of suffering, some pain. In the same way, at the end of a meditation retreat, everyone is happy. It's not because of their insights, it's because the meditation retreat has ended and they can go home. The ending of suffering is happiness. Or sort of, you know, you work really hard and then you sort of finish your university degree. That's happiness, because you're ending of suffering. Whatever it is, the ending of a disease, the ending of struggle, the ending of strife, the ending of suffering is the definition of happiness. And that happiness which you experience in the jhanas, it has to be some big suffering has ended to give you so much happiness. Ajahn Chah used to say it's like a person who's had a rope tied around their neck since the time they were born. In fact, even before they were born. They never knew, never can remember the time they didn't have this rope tied around their neck with two strong men pulling on either end, choking them. They get used to that. They get used to it, they take it as normal. And then one day these two men sort of release their grip. And for the first time that you can remember, you can breathe. Oh, that's nice. You never realized that was possible before. That's a simile for the mind in deep meditation. There's freedom there. And this idea of freedom is a powerful word, which no one really understands unless you get into jhanas. That's why these are called liberations. We're mokas, we're muttis. These are freedoms. How can you be free living in a monastery, having to keep all these rules? How can you be free just sitting down absolutely still? And that's almost like torture, tying you up. And you can't think this and you can't think that, but that is the way to freedom. Because this is what you feel, this is actually experience in the jhanas, it's amazing freedom. Because a lot of suffering has disappeared, you're free from the torturer of the five senses. Once you get those insights through experience, then you understand why the five senses are dukkha. It doesn't matter about, you know, the worst part of the five senses, like seeing ugly things or hearing rotten sounds or smelling sort of people farting or sort of tasting, you know, really disgusting food or getting sick and having all these piercing pains in your body. Yeah, that's dukkha, but even the pleasurable things are dukkha as well, compared to when everything ceases. That by itself is very powerful insight. And standing on that, as it says in the sutras, you can infer that even this mind pleasure, when that stops, that is even greater freedom, greater happiness. And if that doesn't take you to enlightenment straight away, realizing that all the six senses, including the mind, is subject to cessation, is dukkha, is suffering. Even the jhana experiences, you get the message from this, that this too is suffering. At the time you don't know it because you don't know it's ceasing yet. It feels like the greatest happiness you can ever have, but you get the message, the inference. If the greatest happiness I've felt in the sense world, when that disappears, that's happiness. The greatest happiness I feel in the mental world, what happens when that ceases? Yeah, that's great happiness. And if you can't make that jump straight away, you just, you know, go through the jhanas, go from first to second, second to third, third to fourth, go into the immaterial realms. In each case, there's a part of that happiness is disappearing. Pity disappears, first of all. Then sukha disappears. You've given up your mental happiness. Why? Because it's much better when it's all disappeared. Even the bliss of the jhanas, from the standpoint of cessation, is known as suffering. And when the Buddha said that sabbe sankhara dukkha, all sankharas are dukkha, my goodness, you realize that the most important term in those three words is sabbe, or whole complete works is suffering. The result of that, you get through the gateway of desirelessness. I think it's apanahita or something, vimoka. When you see everything is suffering, every object of the six senses, every sense by itself, every vedana, every contact born of those senses is dukkha, as we've been chanting for the rains retreat. Imagine actually knowing that, seeing that, experiencing that. My goodness, that's called enlightenment. That's freedom. You can't desire anything anymore. Why do you desire something? Why do you aspire for the jhanas at the moment? A lot of times because you think it's going to be fun. It is fun, and it's worthwhile sort of following that delusion for the time being, because it's a following of delusion which will lead to the end of delusion. So you can go for that one. It's not so dangerous. But after a while, seeing the whole of samsara is just dukkha, just a mass of dukkha, how can there ever be any craving after that? How can there ever be any reaching out for something? Just, you know, whatever you reach out for, it's just another form of dukkha. Like I was saying about this idea of when I was a young monk, seeing all those fat monks on the top of the line, oh, wouldn't it be nice to be a fat monk like them? You know, I can be the one who chooses my food first of all, and get whatever I want, and also that once I'm the abbot of the monastery, I can tell all the other monks what to do. And as everyone knows, once they're in position of authority, oh, it's true, there's much of the young monk's suffering which I don't have anymore. But instead I've got abbot suffering. Every Wednesday night I've got to come up here and give a talk. After the meal I've got to talk to everybody, sometimes till 1 o'clock. Any problems in the monastery, I'm the one who has to fix them. Anyone who goes crazy and mad in this monastery, I'm the one, someone comes to my door, knock, 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 someone's gone crazy, someone's killing themselves, and I'm the one who has to deal with these things. Why do I have to do all this stuff? I've got abbot dukkha. And so you realize that sometimes we think, okay, that sort of, I want to become a monk. You're just exchanging anagarika dukkha for novice dukkha. You want to become a novice to be a monk. You're just exchanging novice dukkha. Novice dukkha disappears when you become a monk. You get monk dukkha instead. So all of those anagarikas who can't wait to get out of the kitchen. You get ready to get out of the kitchen, but then you go upstairs, so you get upstairs suffering instead of downstairs suffering. All those of you waiting to leave the monastery to go home, through all the suffering of monastic life, you know, not being able to do this, that all disappears when you leave. But instead of that, instead of monastery suffering, you get lay people suffering. So you're not escaping from suffering that way, it's just giving up one suffering from another suffering. That's what I tell for lay people. They want to get married and find a nice partner in life. Say, look, you're just abandoning single person suffering and getting married people suffering. So you get married. And then after a while being married, the marriage is suffering. So you want to get divorced and get single persons suffering again. We always think that we're going to get married to get married people's happiness. We get divorced to get single persons happiness. It's just one type of suffering for another type of suffering, isn't it? So all that reaching out in the world, I want to get a job, I want to get rich. Getting rich is just abandoning poor person's suffering to get rich person's suffering. I know rich people, they have a lot of suffering. You don't end suffering by being rich. You just change one type of suffering for another type of suffering. You just see this whole samsara, it just promises you, if you just change this, if you go there, if you get this, when you're sick, you've got sick person suffering. When you're healthy, healthy person suffering. You can't get out of suffering in this universe. You go up to the heaven realms. You get heaven being suffering. You get into the jhana realms. You get jhana realm suffering. One day it's going to end. Just, this is the nature of this world. Sabbe sankhara dukkha. The whole lot is suffering. It's just a bad apple. Just with the rottenness right to the core, every molecule of that apple is permeated with suffering. The whole, it's rotten. When you realize that, you get sort of disgust, nibbida, and just you throw things away, craving disappears. How can you crave when you know things are suffering? That is the ending of craving, the ending of attachment. It's the desirelessness. And imagine if you really had that degree of desirelessness, this would be your last birth. Just the craving, the seed for rebirth, that which propels you to change things, the want to change your heart, to change your diet, to change your body, to change your lifestyle, to come here and go there, whatever. All that change business, reaching out from desire, from craving, is gone. You've seen dukkha, apanihita, and the last, anatta. My goodness, that's a powerful one. The seed from the jhanas, the will is gone. One of the, what I keep on saying, one of the two citadels of the self, or the self delusion. Think, I am the one who does. You ain't the one who does. I've spoken a lot about that, so I'm going to go on to the second citadel. I am the one who knows. And in jhanas, you see, so much knowing has disappeared. It's completely gone. Who did this? Not me. Certainly, if you experience in jhanas, you see, so much of what you took to be yourself has completely vanished. In particular, the will, the controller. Because, you know, to do is to be. This is, you know, part of ourself. It's also the other part of ourself is the owner. The owner is part of the controller, because what we own, we want to control. You know, even in those of you who've been staying in your hut or in your room for the last 3 months or year or 2 years, however, don't you have sort of proprietary rights over your room or your hut? As if that's, you know, your area, your safe space, you think you own that. Short while, you have to give it up. You don't own that at all. That point was made very clear to me once when I went overseas for a couple of weeks. When I came back, they'd moved my hut. All my stuff was in the other room. I didn't mind, because I don't own those huts. Who knows, when I go over to Melbourne or to Malaysia next time, they may even put all my stuff in the A-frame. I don't know. Doesn't matter, I don't mind. Then someone can have, you know, the number one hut, they can do all the work. So, or that type of work, I have to do other work. But we have these proprietary spaces which we think are me and mine. And that space becomes our body. Our body is me and mine. You see, the body disappearing, Giles, it can't be me and mine. This identification, being a male, being a female, being English, being German, being Dutch, being Sri Lankan, all that identification will completely disappear when you get this body going. Sick and healthy, old or young, that all absolutely goes. And that's actually a lot of self is actually what you look like, your age, your whatever else it is, because so many people worry about that. Your health or your sickness. These things make up the real self which you attach to. Real in the sense of real for you, not real according to Dhamma. What we take to be real. After a while we see those things as not essential, not me, not mine, not a self, because they disappear and it's much happier without them. And it's when the body disappears. It's so powerful to have the body disappear. All the Kaya Gata Sati, the mindfulness of the body, reaches its peak when the body goes in jhanas. Again, things disappear, and then you know what the body is when it's no longer there. Seeing that, you understand fully. People think they understand they're not the body. But, you know, you wait until you sort of somebody comes with a knife running through the monastery, about to cut you on the jugular. Are you afraid? What are you afraid for? It's much better being murdered than having to go through all this long cancer treatments and then go through old age. If someone comes with a knife and about to kill you, if you're now an arahant, oh, thanks very much, let's get it over with. Having the barn is waiting. Why are we so attached to our body? We're so afraid when we see a snake coming, about to kill us. What are you afraid of? What are you afraid of? Is this like fear of losing what you think is yours? Body, 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 body. Health, health, health. So all of these things that when we get into jhanas, we're not so afraid of these things anymore. We can let things go. The body's not mine, nothing to do with me, just a vehicle for the time being. But even further than that, the mind. I've already mentioned the will not being yours, the consciousness not being yours. At least we think, I am the one who knows. So we want to sort of be enlightened and know we're enlightened and know that bliss forever and ever and ever, and live happy ever after, like, you know, the two lovers riding off into the sunset. This is what most people think nibbana is, just, you know, the jitta riding off into the sunset with nibbana, hand in hand, never to be parted. Silly idea, isn't it, when I put it that way? It's like the end of a nice movie. That's all it is, just the delusion of fantasy. But so when you actually get into these jhanas, especially get through a couple of jhanas, you start to see the knower, or the rather the knowing, starts to just fade away. Now this is a powerful sort of, you know, last resort of the sense of self. That's why so many traditions, you know, they take sort of, you know, like God to be consciousness, cosmic consciousness, the ground of consciousness, ultimate consciousness. There's a reason for that, because this is the last resort of the sense of self, the last resort of the illusion. And only when we see consciousness start to fade and disappear, my goodness, that can't be, that's impermanent. The knower, it just fades away, the jitta disappears, it's fragmentary, there's parts, and it's the whole solid foundation of what we thought was our world of consciousness just again starts to melt, fragment, just go into little drops and then sort of disappear into the void with nothing left. Cessation, nibbana, everything gone. Standing on just one or two experiences of those, of the jhanas, where consciousness has changed. That's why they can call them not altered states of consciousness, but sort of, I suppose, what's a nice word, like destroyed states of consciousness. Sort of only partial stages of consciousness, if you like. There's bits of consciousness are just flaking off and disappearing, just like peeling an apple. Just the outer consciousness, then the inner consciousness, then the seeds of consciousness, and everything gone in Nirodha. And the experience of that, standing on a few of those experiences, you can get the inference that there's nothing here. So that Ajahn Chah always used to say, one, empty, nothing there. That's why that powerful experience I had with Ajahn Chah once, when I was walking, I was supposed to be looking after him this one day. He was having his sauna at Wat Nanachar, and instead of actually helping him that day, so many other monks helping him, he gave a nice talk beforehand, so I just went behind the sala of Wat Nanachar. I can even remember the spot where I sat, and just sat on the concrete there. Ajahn Chah just giving a wonderful talk, and the other monks had taken him off to the sauna. I sat meditation, must have been for quite a while, because when I came out of my meditation, the first thought was just, let's go look after my teacher. So I walked over to the sauna. This is the old sauna, which is now in the place where the sewing room is. Or just a little bit past there. So I went over to try and find Ajahn Chah. In the time I was sitting, he'd gone to the sauna, you know, undressed, and, you know, gone into the sauna and stayed there and finished, because he was walking back, almost going, ready to go back to Wat Bafong. And I was just going in the opposite direction, just, you know, just one monk. He was with about two or three laymen, Thai laymen. And he stopped, and he looked at me, and it was one of those Kuba Ajahn looks, which go right through you. And he obviously saw I'd just been in some nice samadhi, so he said, Ajahn Brahm, you know, so he did say Ajahn Brahm, he said, Brahma Wangsa, Tamai. I always remember that. It means, Brahma Wangsa, why? It's an odd question, isn't it, to ask you, why? You know what I answered? Malu? I don't know, I said. And he laughed and he said, yeah, if anyone ever asks you that question again, the answer to the question why is, my me arai. There's nothing. My me arai, nothing there. And he asked me afterwards, do you understand? And I said, yeah. And he said, bo. Bo means, no you don't, it's stupid. Where was it ever that? He asked me. He gave me the clue, you know, the clue to the answer to the question why. What's the answer to the question why? There's nothing. So do you all understand now? No, you don't. That's the last place we're ending the talk on Anatta. The last gateway is Sunyata. From Anatta you get emptiness. Mami arai, nothing there.
Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangha.